If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Stop blaming it on holiday stress. We all know it's that time of year when everything feels drained, both your wallet and you. Well, the real problem is right under you. It's that saggy, old, unsupportive mattress. Well, say hello to Ghostbed. Ghostbed is family-run, consumer-loving, with over 20 years of mattress-making mastery. They've engineered the perfect sleep weapon. Durable, insanely comfortable, and cool enough to keep you chill all night long. Every Ghostbed packs their exclusive ProCore technology, a powerhouse support system that cradles your back, supports, and aligns your spine. Translation? You wake up feeling like a human again. Hot sleeper? Ghostbed's cooling materials fight heat 24/7, so you don't wake up sweaty, even when the thermostat that's cranked up. And here's the kicker. Fast, free shipping in just 2 to 5 days. A 101-night sleep trial and up to a 25-year warranty. That's confidence. Right now, Ghostbed is slashing prices. Up to 50% off compared to other brands. And because you're listening, you score an extra 10% off site-wide. Just use promo code PODCAST at checkout. That's PODCAST for 10% off on top of already insane deals. Upgrade your sleep, upgrade your life. Ghostbed, the coolest beds in the world.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
Eclipsing the West, China, India, and the forging of a new world as the international order begins to crumble. This incisive book asks what the rise of the Asian superstar states means for the future. It's been written by Sir Vince Cable. You will obviously know him from a lifetime in politics, of course, MP for Twickenham, also serving in the Cabinet as Secretary of State for Business Innovation and Skills. Delighted to say that Sir Vince joins us live on the line now. Good morning to you, Sir Vince. Where do we find you?
Morning. Good morning. Thank you. I'm in my home in Twickenham, where I've been for 50 years. But lovely to be invited onto your program.
Pleasure is all mine. We hear an awful lot about the rise of the super states, the new Asian, not so much tigers, because they're particularly bigger than tigers. Should we be unduly nervous about dealing with China and India? Is this a wake-up call, Sir Vince?
I don't think we should be nervous or frightened. I think just recognizing the reality, which I think was inevitable historically, that these vast countries, which have in both cases a population about 20 times that of the UK, you know, we're going to rise economically, and with an economic rise would go growing military influence and political influence. And that's something that's inevitable. I think we have to be grown up about it. I think we have to recognize the context and build relationships. It's more difficult in China's case because it is, as we know, an authoritarian one-party state with different values, but it's perfectly possible to work with them. We have common interests. We live on the same planet, share the same environment. There are, you know, common economic interests. India's easier, and India is so far less developed, but you know, we're going to have to get used to this and not just treat these countries as enemies because they're economically stronger.
We've always sort of looked to the United States. We've always been in Europe. We've been West-centric. We've always looked across the Atlantic for our strongest trading relationships and our backup and our, and if you like, our big brother. But of course, recent developments in the, you know, huge shake-ups in the political order have meant that Europe stroke Britain has to look eastwards and particularly sort of southeastwards for the future and not be so sort of Anglo-centric?
I think that's absolutely right. It may be a bit of a cliche, but the description of Britain's relationship with the United States as a vassal state, I'm afraid, does have elements of truth in it, and particularly the terms of the agreement we struck for tariffs and the fact that our Prime Minister has to abase himself before the President of the United States to get a hearing. I mean, these are not good signs. And I think we've just got to recognise that although the United States has many great features, I mean, I'm not anti-American. I mean, it's a massively innovative country with enormous strengths and what's in the jargon is called soft power. I think we have to respect that. But the problem is it has been for a long time relatively declining, not declining in absolute terms, but relatively declining relative to these new powers in Asia. And in addition, Trump has accelerated the process. You know, but when you trash your great strengths, you know, your science base and your universities, when you put up barriers to the rest of the world, when you erratically maneuver from one thing to another at a time that the Chinese are planning 20 years ahead, I mean, it's clear that the process of American leadership is declining very fast.
And in a world of sort of globalization where we've seen manufacturing of the old industries, for example, I was chatting to a gentleman who set up who's one of the leading shoe manufacturers, and all his stuff, you know, all the fashion and all clothing business comes out of that particular part of the world, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, etc. China, of course, you only need to look at the inside of anything that you're wearing. It seems to say made in China. So the as we've become more global in terms of trade, obviously businesses move that way because nobody wants to pay more than they have to for their goods. And that wields an awful lot of influence as well, I suppose, Vince.
It's no longer just an issue about clothes and shoes. I mean, that was true, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. We're now talking about advanced engineering. I think in almost all the key technologies of the world, China is ahead or approaching equality, particularly in the sort of new green technologies, you know, to do with renewable energy, electric-driven transport, and so on. So and the emergence of DeepSeek, for example, as an AI learning model was a kind of wake-up call. But it isn't just China. You know, India is a different kind of country. It's democratic, but it's developing very rapidly. In the last few years, for example, they've now become the largest importer of artificial intelligence applications. They will use them. Every Indian is now connected through a very sophisticated digital system. So, you know, it's throughout Asia, but particularly in the big super states, that this enormous emergence of energy is coming. I think China is particularly difficult for people to get their head around because it now dominates the world in manufacturing terms. They've developed this remarkable, about, I think, 120, 130 million people now working in manufacturing particularly in the south of China. And they've mastered the art of, you know, process engineering and of linking manufacture through its many supply chain applications and so on. So they now dominate world manufacturing. Technologically, they're approaching probably at parity with the United States. Of course, there are things that the Americans still have. The world still uses the dollar as a currency. It will continue to do so for quite a long time. And a lot of power goes with that. The United States is militarily far superior to China, though the Chinese are arming. Again, India is one step further back. Yeah, there are, you know, different ways of looking at this, but in terms of basic economics, basic technology, and above all, manufacturing industry, we have long since been eclipsed.
And the other thing is, of course, is that both China and India have highly educated baselines, educated workforce. If you think, you know, the India's got a, you know, many universities. Obviously, people joke about, oh, my call centres in somewhere in India, but that implies a level of education that perhaps Europe can only dream of, and China as well, because they have invested in their young people and a level of education that puts them at the forefront of the new technologies. I mean, we can talk about America having a huge army, but perhaps the next conflict will come online, as we've seen. And therefore, it doesn't matter how many aircraft carriers you've got if you can't get the systems to work because they're being hacked by somebody out the back of Beijing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And of course, amongst the many things the Chinese are technologically ahead on or appear to be is drones, right? Which we're now discovering are the main instrument of war. And as you're behind all these technologies, as you rightly say, are people. And the Chinese have been brilliant at developing engineering and engineers. The recent book said, you know, the conflict between the US and China is between lawyers and engineers. And certainly they have a vast supply of engineering people, scientists. And although a lot of kind of more liberal-minded people are leaving China because they find the system very oppressive, a lot of scientists are going back because they have an opportunity, they're respected, they're well-paid, they've got remarkable projects that they can work on. And similarly, the Indians, there are some pretty dreadful public sector universities in India, but there are also very sophisticated institutes of management and engineering which are churning out vast numbers of very highly qualified, skilled people and are making India the global center for business services, for example, not just simple coding and call center work, but more advanced, sophisticated operations.
Here's two things that strike me, because I'm born in the 60s, so grew up in the 70s, teenager in the 80s, and the world has changed immeasurably since then. So China was always impenetrable. We didn't know much about it. Even Nixon's visit to China in 72 was like the first huge step. And India, of course, we now have, because of the empire and our relation with that, and how do we restructure our relations? Because we're always taught of, if you look at the front page of the papers, it's always, you know, Chinese spies are in your phone or in your microwave oven or whatever. Don't put your Bluetooth on. And India, it seems to be that we are suffering, or are we suffering, Sir Vince, a kickback from the abuses of empire?
Well, there's several powerful points there. I mean, China started opening to the world around about 1980. They'd had Mao Zedong and the very revolutionary, chaotic sort of period. But Deng Xiaoping opened China to the world. They started trading on a massive scale, importing ideas where they could get them. And certainly for the most of the period since, China has been much more engaged with the world. The current leader, Xi, appears to be closing doors, trying to turn China more into a fortress. But I don't totally buy this stuff about, you know, Chinese spy under every bed. All countries engage in spying. The Chinese, I don't think, are particularly good at it. The more recent scandal involved getting somebody to work with a Labour MP who was so obscure nobody knew who he was, and some Tory MPs who the information they got was published in the Daily Telegraph. I mean, it's very difficult to see what spying was actually going on here. So I think there's quite a bit of paranoia. We shouldn't believe, you know, we shouldn't be naive. They're tough people and they can be ruthless, but there's a difference between paranoia and naivety. Somewhere in the middle is where we need to believe. In the Indian case, they went through a very long period of becoming much more inward-looking, trying to build up their industry as a reaction to the way that they had been left after colonialism, a long period of inward-looking development and non-alignment. And that's changed in recent years, mainly thanks to a great figure in India called Manmohan Singh. And he opened up the economy, made it much more efficient and more outward-looking, which is partly why, you know, you now have this generation of Indians, you know, running all the world's top companies. And, you know, you've got this new elite of very outward-looking people who are very comfortable with the most advanced technologies. I think long since moved away from what they were doing as a reaction to colonial rule. I think that's all in the past. Britain is just another medium-sized country that they want good relations with.
As a Liberal Democrat, is it not perturbing or slightly worrying that these are both? I mean, Modi is a populist in India, and obviously we know China has, to put it mildly, has some questions to answer on their human rights record. With Russia, we put our trust in the fact that if there was a McDonald's and, I don't know, a Burger King on every corner, then they would embrace Western democracy. How should we should we approach doing business with or dealing with China specifically, perhaps to a lesser extent India, with the hope that we can perhaps influence their rights records?
Well, a lot of my liberal friends are horrified by the fact that I go backwards and forwards and I speak up for engagement with China. India's less of a problem, but certainly the current leader in India has questions to answer about various pogroms that occurred with the Muslim minority. But, I mean, my view is we have no alternative but to treat this in a business-like way. I think the two worst things we could do, and we're in danger of doing, is completely ignoring them, turning our back on them because we're squeamish about some of the bad things that have happened there, or, and even worse, standing on a pulpit and lecturing them and telling them how they should behave. I mean, those things go down terribly badly and are completely counterproductive. So I think we just have to recognize Britain is a somewhat shrunken force in the world with many good things to offer. I love Britain, but we're no longer a great power. We can't tell the rest of the world what to do and have to approach it with a certain humility. And we're now, you know, reasonably isolated because of Brexit. We're not on our own. We can't hide behind the European Union. And simply, we're not in a position, really, to dictate morality for the rest of the world. Of course, not just China and India, but countries like Saudi Arabia. You know, I'd once have been horrified at having to deal with them on the basis of equality, but we now have to.
And in a world where people are making grandiose statements from various pulpits, as you put it, across the pond, you know, in the UK about migration and this, that, and the other, and as you said, the current Prime Minister abasing himself, which I thought was a particularly interesting word, in front of Donald Trump. I mean, do we need a period of, as what Willie Bram called, real politics? And the UK in particular needs to recognise that it isn't Great Britain anymore. And also, how do these, because you go to China a lot, how does China see the UK? Is it just this strange little nation that is no longer part of a quite useful and powerful bloc, i.e. the European Union?
Yeah, I think that the Chinese are very keen to build bridges to Asia. I mean, one of the things which happened some years ago is they now have a railway connection to a place called Duisburg in Western Germany. And, you know, they saw Europe, I think, predominantly as a market for their goods, as a way to, you know, develop technology, mostly honestly, sometimes dishonestly, and to, you know, build up a relationship with Europe, which they saw as not being the United States. That has all soured, particularly with Britain, but the Germans have become worried that they were, you know, over-dependent on the Chinese market. And the most difficult relationship now between China and Europe is over the Ukraine war, because although the Chinese haven't openly supported the Russians, and indeed they're critical of some of the things they do, we do see them as a Russian ally. And therefore, since we're pouring support weapons into Ukraine, rightly in my view, I think we should be supporting the Ukrainians, the Chinese are seen as being on the other side. And this has made it actually quite difficult in the last few years to maintain a good relationship with the Chinese. I think we'll get past that, but it is currently a sticking point.
What are you hoping that people are going to take from your book? Is it because, as you say, you go over to China, India, various times through the year, are you trying to shine the light and say, let's not use prejudices, let's not be afraid, this is the way that the next 10, 20, 30 years, the next generation are going to have to do, we're going to have to refocus the way that we look at the world and look more towards the East, as the saying goes?
Well, I think that's a very good way of summarizing it. Just personally, I mean, I've been coming and going from India, although I'm primarily thought of as a British politician, but I've been working in terms of business, academic work. I have an Indian family also through my first wife, late wife. And I've been going backwards and forwards to China for about 30 years. So I try to see the big picture. I don't claim to be an expert on either country. I don't speak the language, the local language. These are vast places with enormous complexity, and my own knowledge is superficial, necessarily so. So I don't claim an enormous amount, but what I am trying to do is remain curious and to have an open mind, and I'm encouraging my readers to think about the future. It's very easy to, in the West particularly, to react to day-to-day events. That's the way we've somehow become. To try to think, you know, what will the world be like in 20 years' time, when China may well be the biggest economy in the world, certainly the superpower, so if not a superpower alongside the United States. And India, potentially the second or third biggest economy in the world. These are the two countries that more than ever, any other, will determine whether or not we're successful in dealing with climate change and what flows from that. Potential conflicts involving, you know, horrors, nuclear weapons, partly depends on how China and India are able to work together and work with everybody else. A whole lot of sort of global problems which these countries hold the key to, and I'm trying to get my readers to try and anticipate a world in which, you know, the center of gravity of the world is moving, and we need to move with it.
But do you think that our current crop of world leaders who aren't in India and China have the skill set to appreciate the complexities and the historical background that we're going to need, and not try and paint these two massive nations in two dimensions, and realize the cultures, the nuances that have made the country?
Well, I'm moderately optimistic on that score, actually. I mean, there are many criticisms you can make of the British government. I do make them from time to time. But actually, I think in terms of they're trying to get the right balance with China, and certainly with India. There are a lot of noises off. We read headlines about spy scares and this kind of thing, but actually the government itself is pretty pragmatic and sensible. And even the Trump administration, I know, you know, I'm probably more than anybody critical of Trump and the way he behaves, but actually his transactional way of looking at the world, it may be a bit crass, and certainly in India's case, has sort of turned them off completely. But actually, in his dealings with China, he recognizes high levels of competence. He deals with Xi with some respect. And I'm reasonably confident that I think the worry on the other side is that President Xi is the all-powerful leader of the Communist Party in China. He's a very smart, operator, but is becoming increasingly paranoid. And the big question, which Chinese don't address publicly, but all think about privately, is what happens when he goes? I mean, he's passing 70. He will die at some point, certainly get sick. There's no succession organized. We simply don't know what will happen. So there's a worrying issue around the leadership. India is more democratic, so there will be a kind of democratic process, though the BJP government, the Hindu nationalist government, has done its best to undermine opposition voices and parties. So in terms of, actually, I think from our point of view in the UK, we've at government level, at least, there's a reasonable amount of sanity in terms of these relationships.
The book is called Eclipsing the West, China, India and the Forging of a New World. It's by Sir Vince Cable, who we're speaking to today. If people want to find, and listeners, you can go to our virtual bookstore, click on the front page and a well-known distribution service will have it winging its way to you. If people want to find you online and say nice things to you, Sir Vince, where's the best place to find you? Are you TikToking? Are you WhatsApp? Where can people find you online?
Well, I'm certainly on WhatsApp, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm still on X, despite Mr. Musk. I haven't cancelled my account. I'm not a great social media communicator. I actually, strangely, I'm a social media influencer in China. I have a Red Note account, and apparently I've vastly large numbers of followers, even more than in the UK. So if you happen to be contacting me from China, Red Note is the social media.
Well, it's been wonderful to speak to you today. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. The book is called Eclipsing the West, China, India and the Forging of a New World. Listeners, order it via our virtual bookstore. Sir Vince Cable, thank you so much for your time today.
And thank you for interviewing me. I really appreciate it.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year, and we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.